No, there ain't nothing that I gotta prove. You think your words will make me black and blue, but I think I'm pretty with these old boots on. I think it's funny when I drink too much. Hey, you try and change me, you can go to hell. 'Cause I don't wanna be nobody else. I like the chip I got in my front teeth, and I got bad tattoos you won't believe. So kick out the jams, kick up the soul, pour another glass of that rock and roll. Turn up the band, find the hole, gonna lose control tonight. What do you want from me? I'm not a Mary the sweetheart.
Welcome to the show, Tuesday, so December the 13th. Just had my Christmas brain blown a little bit as I'm going through the stuff that we want to talk about today. There's all kinds of it that are on different levels of seriousness, and we will absolutely be serious and delve into some of those topics today. But I just read this, and it kind of blew my mind that I've been alive for almost 41 years, and I didn't know that. Did you guys know you're not supposed to stuff the turkey? You're not supposed to. What is called stuffing. Well, where I come from, it's called dressing. Maritimers call it dressing. Everybody else seems to call it stuffing. But I just read this little blurb in the pile of fun that says if you stuff the turkey, it's going to dry out the bird because, of course, you have to leave it in the oven longer, up to 40 minutes longer with the stuffing in the turkey. And we've heard before that you're supposed to, like, that if you put the stuffing in the bird, it's probably going to kill you. Salmonella, some sort of terrible bacteria. And I figured, you know what? I've eaten a lot of turkey. As a matter of fact, I come from a long line of turkey farmers, and I've never poisoned myself with dressing. But now that it's saying that the meat will be better if you don't stuff it, I think I got to try it. All the stuffing on the side is what this is saying. And isn't that, because you can't ever fit enough stuffing in the turkey. So I always cook some on the side anyway. But then when the turkey's done, I take the stuffing out of the bird and mix it with the stuff that I cooked on the side to make sure that it's got some sort of, like, fatty poultriness in it. So I don't know. I'm just thinking that I'm going to have to reconfigure Christmas. Figure this out. One time I recall my mother deciding one Christmas that she wanted to switch it up. She's a bit of a foodie, and she tried this recipe for wild rice and smoked oyster dressing, and she and I loved it. And I don't think my brother and my father, either of them, were very impressed. They were like, there's no bread in this stuffing, hence it's not stuffing. And I think if they could have revolted and left, you know, they might have, but it was Christmas Day and everything was closed, so they stayed. Anyway, changing the way we have thought about dressing and stuffing. I think I'm going to try this. Not that I feel like my birds have ever been dry. Nobody's ever said that to me. But do people tell you that? They wouldn't tell you if the meat was dry, would they? They would just, like, slop more gravy on it and pretend it was the best thing they ever had. All right. Anyway, word of the year. We're going to talk about that. What is the word of the year? I like this one. I like this word of the year. We'll get to that coming up. The vast and overwhelming majority of people who voted for Jones in Alabama last night were black women. So first of all, let's hear it for them. These women who ensured that a pedophile, misogynist, homophobe, racist, I mean, I could go on, man did not get into that Senate seat. That's wonderful. But why is this reliant on black women? These numbers are staggering. We're going to get to that coming up, too. Karen Sehan is a columnist and a frequent flyer here on 570 News. She is going to join us coming up after 9:30 this morning. She wrote a column in the Chronicle this week, which talked about a situation that I think probably a lot of us have found ourselves in. Ladies and allies and men who seem to be on the side of the hashtag Me Too. And she tells a story about a friend of hers getting in touch over the weekend where this friend was at a gym working out, and she was the only woman there. And there were three men in there who were very, very noisily going on about, you know, those women wrongfully accusing men and how hostile the women were, which, of course, made that environment kind of hostile. And what do you do in that situation? How do you react in that situation? I don't feel like I'm doing it very well, because I had a similar situation over the weekend. And I think I'm so passionate about it that when I hear those conversations, I get incensed so quickly that I'm easily angered by the ignorance. Why didn't they report it? Why, oh God, can I even work with a woman now? Why would they? No, look, it's a warlock hunt. Like, all of that stuff makes me unable to form clear thoughts. And I get angry about it, and then I don't feel like I'm communicating it well. I think that Karen talks about this kind of interesting situation we're in now, where we kind of have to choose whether we react to that when we hear it, or we don't. And if we don't, are we being complacent? If we don't, are we failing the cause? We're going to talk about that after 9:30. Okay, let's start here with the elf on a shelf. I love this story. There's a mom in Newfoundland. Her name's Sherry Gillum. And she is spreading Christmas cheer with costumed photos of herself. So she is literally, Sherry is the elf on a shelf. She's from Bonavista, Newfoundland, not your typical elf on a shelf. And she's taken this Christmas craze, I mean, even further. She's dressing up in an elf costume, taking daily photos of herself, getting into all sorts of mischief. So if your babies are in the car right now, we're going to speak frankly about Christmas and the elf. We're going to talk about it. So if you don't want to destroy Christmas magic right now, then might I suggest that you come back to us in a couple minutes? Because I think that people, actually, I think there are three groups of people now when it comes to that elf on a shelf. There are the people who love it, the parents who love it. They're very good at it. They never have an extra glass of wine and forget to move the elf. These are the good parents. I mean, these are the sanctimonious and darn well entitled to it people who are just really good at putting their children first all of the time. Then there are the people who despise the elf on a shelf because you're using it as a parenting tool. You know, you're using it to inspire the children to behave themselves, and that's not okay. The children can't just be threatened by an elf flying to Santa to tell Santa that the children have been naughty. That's not how you inspire good behavior. You need to have better parenting techniques than that. So these people also really good parents. So you got your yes elf on the shelf good parents, you've got your no elf on the shelf good parents. And then you have the group that I fall into, the people who were like exuberant and enthusiastic about the elf, got the elf, put it on the shelf, and then realized, oh my God, what have I done? I have just set myself up for like probably a decade of this stupid elf whose creative antics are completely my responsibility. How do I do this? Wait, I don't even want to do this. Okay, star 570 519 570 2545. I want to know if there's an elf in your house. I want to know if you regret the elf coming to your house. I want to know if you think poorly of the parents who forget to move the elf. Or if you're one of those amazing people who never does. Is it a bad parenting tool? Is it a parenting tool at all? 519-570-2545. 1-800-570-5715. Jennifer at 570news.com will work as well as star 570. Did I say star 570? Probably did. Because people are really passionate about this. And it seems like everybody has one these days, has the Elf on a shelf. So let's get back to, and the people that don't, oh my God, I'm so jealous of you. I'm so jealous of you and your Elf-free house, because it's just such a burden, especially during like this time of the holidays. I try to be happy about it and pretend like it's wonderful, but honestly, it just, all it does is add stress to my life. It's a Christmas stress. So Sherry Gillum, back to Newfoundland as we wait for your calls on whether or not the Elf is a handy thing, or is it a completely backwards parenting tool that all of us should just kind of stop doing. So this woman in Newfoundland first put on an Elf costume last Christmas. She was playing a role in a play at church. And then she put on the suit, and then her two-year-old really liked it. Her little guy liked it, and he, you know, kind of got used to seeing her in it and not be scared. And then spontaneously, she decides to get in her son's crib with the costume on for a photo, which then makes the rounds on Facebook. And all of her family and friends love her dressed up as the Elf, and they ask her to continue doing that. So now, look, gosh, I think I feel pressure with the Elf. So she does. She does. She continues with the Elf on a shelf, and the people love it. She loves it. People love it. But God, the pressure that she has, because now she has filled a bathtub with marshmallows, large marshmallows. She has filled a bathtub with them. She's like pictured in the bathtub drinking the maple syrup with the cookies on her eye. Gosh, I thought I was super creative for putting them in the fridge. She's, you know, had a little nap on top of the mantle. She has gone out and posed with a local hockey team, letting them shoot pucks at her. And she's taking all these pictures. And she says that, you know, it's been good for her because she's actually kind of shy. So this has been really good for her. Her husband takes the photos. Her mom and friends help her come up with new ideas for where to pose next. They say, maybe you should try this. Maybe you should try that. This would be a good one. She said, I'm not as small as that little Elf on a shelf doll. But she says it makes people happy. She's kind of a reserved person, but she's putting herself out there to make others smile during the holidays, including her children. She doesn't have to remember to move. She just has to remember to move herself as the Elf. All right. So we'll take some of your answers about if it's a good parenting tool or if it's the worst parenting tool. Emails seem to be coming in. Jennifer@570news.com. Or again, you can call us at *570-519-570-2545. And I mean, it makes me an even worse mother to say, not only do I forget to move the Elf on the shelf sometimes, I resent him. I'm angry at the Elf on a shelf. I'm absolutely on the naughty list, for sure. Ass planted firmly on the naughty list. And I'm not even upset about it. 9:17. Let's come back to that after the break. And we will also talk about that election in Alabama last night after this.
When extreme weather hits, count on the 570 Extreme Weather Center.
I must say, and I will admit, I was not hopeful for what that situation in the states in Alabama would play out to be last night. I wasn't. I mean, after the past year that we've had, I wasn't very hopeful that people, you know, would embrace, you know, the right side of history on this one. So never forget. I mean, this is something that kind of resonated with me this morning that I read after the election and after Jones was the winner on Twitter. This is from Mikhail Gillette on Twitter, who said, after Roy Moore said gay people should be put in jail, after he said the country was better off under slavery, after he said Muslims have no place in public life, after he was outed as a serial pedophile, the GOP endorsed him and funded his campaign. And I think that's important. I mean, that's where we're at. Or perhaps that's where they were at, because a Democrat hasn't been voted in to the state Senate since 1992 in Alabama. Of course, that was Democratic Senator Richard Shelby. He won that and then switched to the Republican Party a couple years after that. But this race, you know, Moore's profile, insisting over and over again that he was speaking on the part of Christianity and God, even through those allegations and accusations from women who said he pursued relationships with them while they were teenagers when he was in his 30s. Remember too, that he got banned from the mall. The mall cops knew he was trouble. It was a uniquely competitive race in Alabama last night. But if a Democrat can win in Alabama, a Democrat can win just about anywhere in the country. So it is still daunting for the Democrats. 25 Democratic seats are up in 2018 as compared to just 8 for Republicans. But those races, likely for current GOP seats in states like Nevada, Arizona, and Tennessee, there's actually a path for Democrats to win that majority. And that is stunning. So we call it a loss for the Republicans for sure. We call it a loss for Donald Trump. Absolutely. And what an interesting article, too, that I read this morning that was entitled "White People Need to Be Better People." So Doug Jones won Alabama, and those preliminary exit polls point to black voters as the force behind that upset. Black women made up 17% of the voters, and they overwhelmingly voted for Jones at 98%. White women made up 31% of that vote and overwhelmingly voted for Moore. White women, 63% of them did that. And this is via Twitter, too, and a tweet that kind of explained that to me or to us or to people who perhaps didn't quite understand, you know, I don't know why white women are voting for someone who, again, admitted to be sexist and admitted to being, well, he didn't admit to being a pedophile, but he certainly didn't hide his thought processes from us at all. And this is a tweet that I thought was so sad and true. And it is from a woman on Twitter, a black woman on Twitter, who said, "I don't think people get that black women don't turn out because of some maternal instinct to save everyone. We usually get hit first and worst by oppressive policies. So we're saving ourselves. You just benefit from that." I mean, that's telling it like it is, isn't it? It certainly is. So this article called "White People Need to Be Better" talks about, you know, everyone in America needing to thank the black people of Alabama and Ohio and Texas and North Carolina and Pennsylvania and Florida and Georgia and Maryland and Virginia for being bulletproof in that. And then, you know, wondering why they don't find that form of government that completely wretched. All right, it is coming up to 9:30. We are going to get to the news, and we're going to do some shifting here. We've got some stuff happening. We were supposed to have a guest at 9 a.m. that we're probably going to get on just after 9:30. We'll get to that after this on 570 News.
You can scroll through your selfies all day.
Let me take a selfie.
Or put some actual news in your news feed. Click on 570news.com or go to your app store and download the 570 News app.
Talk about Christmas prices in just a second, too. And Amy sends me an email about the elf on a shelf. And she says, hi, Jennifer. Even Psychology Today says it's a bad idea. Calls it a dangerous parental crutch. She said, I remember reading an article when a psychologist said that we should completely bench the elf on a shelf and stop pretending like it is fun. Now, this psychologist also believes that we're terrible parents for telling our children there's a Santa Claus. So perhaps he's at the far end of the spectrum on this. You know, if you start with lies to your children, then they'll never trust you. And the elf on a shelf is absolutely a lie. All right, so we'll get back into that coming up in just a couple minutes. Also, we're going to speak to Alex Krollingen, who is a partner at Van Krollingen and Keenberg, and representing a group of family members, relatives of the murdered seniors. There is a public inquiry happening about the Wettlaufer case and perhaps searching into that this is more of a story than we're aware of, that perhaps there were more things going on in that nursing home than we knew. And of course, what we know is terrible and tragic enough. So we'll get to that coming up for you in just a couple minutes. I read this article from Karen Sehan, who is a big friend of this radio station, 570 News, and a big friend of this community. She wrote a column in the Waterloo Chronicle called I Ask Again, Do You Believe Her? And I read it and wanted to talk to her and you about it. So she joins us this morning. Good morning, Karen. Thanks for coming on with us. Hi, Karen.
Hi.
Hi. Gotcha. Good. Good morning. How you doing?
Kind of went. The feed went dead. Everything went dead there for a minute.
We are having technical difficulties today, and zero of them are my fault, which is that's abnormal. And usually it's me who's pushing the wrong buttons, or sometimes the right buttons, I guess. Okay. So, you know, it's funny because as I read your story, and I'll obviously let you tell it. I was kind of reading along and couldn't wait to hear what the end result was in this story, because I think that a lot of us who have been, you know, talking about sexual harassment and sexual assault and misogyny in our lives, in not just the workplaces, have come to this place where we're tired. And that we come across people who simply keep asking the same questions. And I'm at the point where I'm like, okay, you're asking the wrong question, and I don't feel like the onus is on me all the time to educate everybody anymore, and I kind of find it a little bit frustrating. So let's talk about your story and what happened over the weekend and how you're feeling about it.
Yeah, it's not my story. It was actually a friend of mine. I was out delivering oranges for my Rotary Club, and these messages were coming in quite quickly. And it was a friend of mine. She's a very successful businesswoman in this community. So in the context of her workplace, she hasn't experienced any kind of sexism, et cetera. She actually, it's a kind of interesting scenario because she found herself at the gym on Saturday morning and found herself listening as the only woman in the room to three, she calls them gray-haired gentlemen, going on and on and on about how these women are lying about these accusations and about how they're capitalizing on them and how they have benefited from whatever role they play. They have benefited by building big careers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And she described it as a hostile environment. She did not feel like she could stand up. At one point in time, one of the guys came over and stood right beside her, knowing that she had heard it, and in a big space. And she knew that he was there for a reason. She felt incredibly intimidated, and she didn't say anything. And she was questioning herself so strongly about not saying anything. And that's kind of I think that's the kind of the crux of the conflict for us as women, particularly in leadership roles, is that we're sick and tired of having to just educate people on the basics of decency. And oftentimes we find ourselves in situations that we don't feel like we can.
That's just it. And I think that I think that all speaks to being part of this rape culture. That, you know, it's okay. Well, we're not going to believe her. Obviously, there's something in it. For her. And then I hear a lot of, I know a guy who was falsely accused. Like, instead of defaulting to, wow, this is an epidemic and, you know, these women deserve to be listened to and believed, it defaults to that. I know a guy who, you know, yeah, was wrongfully, accused and those same questions seem to come up, like, well, why would they wait so long? And in mixed company, I mean, I found myself in a situation like this over the weekend. I'm with three people with university degrees. These are people who understand that information is theirs and accessible if they so want it, and are asking those same questions. Why would they wait so long? And without having any desire to have an understanding that is the science of victimology. And I get resentful about the fact that, you know, you're wrong and the information is right there and you could access it if you want to. So all I can assume is that you don't care.
Or I also think there's an element of, I'm completely oblivious to this power dynamic. And the power dynamic isn't something you can, like, quantify, right? You can't read papers about it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's something you have to experience. And whether it is from the position of being a woman or a person of being a person of color or an indigenous person or a person with a disability or a person, that those are the marginalized groups that are below the power level. And so the people who are actually enjoying the power aren't necessarily going to be aware of the power, because it's so normal. It's been so normalized in our culture that, I mean our North American culture, it's broader than that, obviously, but it's such a normal thing that power structure exists, that the people who are enjoying the power have no knowledge of it, unless they're really complicit in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
there's a difference there. Like, I think about last night and the results watching. I know you were watching. I was watching those results coming in from that election. And that man who ran for the Republican Party is complicit in the power. He has benefited and he has helped, you know, enforce the power system. A lot of men in today's society have no clue of what that power system, how it came to be, and why and how they're enjoying it.
So
to their credit, I know a lot of men who are really, really working hard,
yep,
to figure this out.
And have a desire to be kind, yeah, of, you know, awakened in some way to that privilege.
Yeah. Yeah.
How do you then, Karen, in your life, because I don't know that I handle it very well. I quickly get kind of defensive about it and a little bit angry about it. And I just kind of feel like the weight of all of it is, you know, on my shoulders, in situations like this. And I believe too, that, you know, sometimes these topics come up around people like you, like I, because people definitely know that we have, strong opinions on this topic and probably many others. How do you then pace yourself in like a dignified manner? How do you decide when you will respond to this? How do you kind of educate the people around you if this kind of topic comes up without sounding, you know, defensive? Or is that even possible because we're so invigorated by the content?
Well, I have to say I've had a lot of training. You know, I spent a lot of time in the political arena, and I learned some really tough lessons around that, that you can't. I'm of Italian and Irish descent, so my temper is about as fierce as anybody's could be. And I've had to learn over the course of time. This is one of the beauty of aging, is you learn some of these techniques. I've had to learn to breathe and to breathe and to breathe and to understand that every opportunity is a learning experience and a learning opportunity. So I don't react. I don't allow that kind of physical reaction take over anymore. I look at everything as now an opportunity to broaden somebody's awareness. So I've stopped shying away from those conversations. I used to shy away from them. I used to run from them. But now I'm, you know what, I think we're at a point in time, and that was my advice to my girlfriend on that, you know, we're messaging over our cell phone. Mm-hmm. I think we have to say things. We have to say things. Because if we don't say things, then our daughters are going to have the same experiences that we're having and that what we've had. And I'm not willing to allow that to happen anymore. I'm just not.
Yeah.
So that's, I breathe, but I refuse to shy away from the conversation.
I think that another great point that was came to me and I kind of thought about over the weekend, and as always, it's funny how the universe kind of responds to you. I was thinking, like, I couldn't kind of figure out what was bothering me about the sentiment of people around me, close to me, who say, well, you know, God, I'm never going to compliment a woman on her hair anymore. Or I'm never going to say, you know, anything about her outfit anymore. Because in the wake of Weinstein, I mean, you just can't say or do anything, you know. And I didn't know why that kind of irked me as much as I did. And then I saw something, an article on the internet saying that this is part of the rape culture too. Men acting as if that we're overreacting and as if they don't have the basic social skills to know the difference between a wanted or an unwanted advance, which kind of, I mean, again, you're kind of wrapped up in your own feelings about it so much that it took somebody else kind of explaining that to me, you know, that like us setting boundaries is cramping men's style in some way.
Yeah, it's funny. And I keep on, a lot of men are asking me for advice, like how to proceed. And one of my things I tend to say is just try to figure out that you're in the workplace.
Mm-hmm.
Just start there.
Yeah.
Start about thinking about the workplace and understanding that the workplace has a set of rules that needs to be respected in order for people to feel respected in the workplace. That's pretty simple. That's a simple place to start, that everybody can start.
And I often think about too, and is there a power dynamic there? You know, some relationships that I have with my coworkers or my co-host or people who are on the same kind of level as me, and we've been friendly and such for quite some time. I mean, what is our relationship like, and is there a power dynamic there? And if there's not, and both people are participating in the ha ha and the fun and hilarity, then all is probably fine.
Yeah, how do you check in on that, right?
Well, how do you? Yeah.
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 You have to ask somebody before you tell an inappropriate joke.
Know. I think this is a messy time, right? Mm-hmm. And there's going to be lots of mess ahead of us. And it's not going to be, we always look for simple solutions, but there aren't any to these because, you know, it's difficult. It's difficult. It's difficult to understand. But I think what has to happen is that people have to understand that it's really about respecting what other people need,
right?
In terms of a safe and healthy and respectful workplace.
I've had that conversation too, even with some guys that I work with. They say, "Well, God, you know, I don't know what to say anymore. I don't know what to do anymore." And I say, "Stop making it about you. Stop making it about you. It's not about you."
There's a lot of guys who are asking that question with open hearts because they're trying to figure out. They're really trying to figure it out. Like, how do I help? How do I make this happen?
Yeah.
Yeah.
How did
you want to hear how that story?
Yes, please. I'd want to don't leave us hanging with the ending, please.
She felt she had no way to have a conversation with those guys in that space. So I did ask her if the gym she was at had a feedback loop of some sort. And she went down and she spoke to the people at the front desk. And they told her that they have an absolutely zero tolerance for any kind of thing like that. So next time it happened, she would have to come and tell them, and then they would have to come up. But my thought about that was that there you go. You're going to put some likely younger people in a situation of conflict with these guys who are carrying on in their merry way. So really, that to me, that's not a sufficient answer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So what is?
It goes back to that power dynamic that exists in that space. Three men, one woman. She's silenced. They carry on. His friends didn't call him out. His friends need to learn how to call.
That would have been an ideal ending. I mean, if we could do a choose your own adventure ending here, I mean, that would have been ideal if those two men in that conversation had said, dude, not okay. And
dude,
actually, you're misinformed.
Over the line. We need, and that's a really great role for guys in this conversation. It's, you know, call your friends out for being jerks.
Yes.
Period.
Yeah. Yes.
Always a good place to start.
Karen Sian, I just love your words, and I love having you on the show, and I'm always jealous that Mike Farwell gets you each and every week and I don't. So maybe it's time we just fit you in a weekly slot here too. Thank you so much.
If you ever go on a vacation, you know, you can always call me.
Oh, that's the vacation sounds great, but not, you know, you filling in is amazing and I'd be honored, but I don't get to talk to you. So anyway,
I wouldn't know which buttons to press. It would be a disaster.
Don't worry, we'll get you some people for that. Karen Sian is a contributor here on 570 News and a columnist with the Waterloo Chronicle and about a trillion other things that are amazing and wonderful for our community. Thanks, Karen, so much for joining us this morning.
Have a great day, Jen.
Take care. Bye-bye. Okay, let us talk about kind of a continuation of the story when it comes to the Elizabeth Wetlaufer trial. The public inquiry at the request of the relatives of those murdered seniors is set to get underway. We'll talk to the lawyer representing those families, Alex Krollingen, coming up after the break right here on 570 News.
We crowdsource our traffic from the bumper-to-bumper crowd surrounding you.
Real-time traffic solutions from sources across the city and you. Your traffic team is 570 News, Kitchener's breaking news, traffic and weather station.
Okay, so before we get back into, talking about this kind of update and further investigation into the Elizabeth Wetlaufer case, Catherine emails me, Jennifer at 570news.com. Jennifer, can you send along that response you read about men speaking up? Saying things, you know, can I even say a woman has nice hair? So you know what, Catherine, I will send it to you. I do have your email address, and I will read it to you in its entirety just before we move along. And it was posted by someone who I really enjoy on Facebook, my dear internet friend, because we have way more interaction on the internet than we do in real life, Jackie, who always has some really poignant stuff going on. So this is what it says. I think one of my least favorite types of responses to people speaking up on sexual harassment and sexual assault is articles like, in the wake of Weinstein, men wonder if hugging women is still okay. And comments like, this is why men don't pursue women anymore. Or I don't want to work with women because I don't want a lawsuit. Or I don't even look at women anymore because everything is sexual harassment. This is a part of rape culture. Men acting as if women are overreacting, as if men don't have the basic social skills to know the difference between wanted and unwanted advances, as if women setting up boundaries is cramping their style and or emasculating them, as if the rules of respecting women are so super confusing, that they're supposedly forcing men not to interact with us all together. And yes, I will send that along to you, Catherine. Okay, so moving on, we get into this story, or back into the story of Elizabeth Wetlaufer, who, of course, was that nurse convicted of 8 counts of first-degree murder, 4 counts of attempted murder, and 2 counts of aggravated assault. She pled guilty in June. She was sentenced to life in prison with no eligibility for parole for 25 years. The 50-year-old nurse injected her victims with insulin while they were in her care at 3 different Ontario long-term facilities and a private home between 2007 and 2016. Joining us now is Alex Krollingen, who is a partner at Van Krollingen and Keenberg and is the lawyer representing the relatives of these murdered seniors as they take part in a public inquiry. Alex, thank you for coming on with us this morning. I know it's been a busy morning for you.
It has. Thank you. And just to be clear, I'm representing only some of the families and loved ones, not all of them.
Gotcha. Okay. So when we talk about this case, which of course we know has at least that part of it, she has been convicted. She has pled guilty. We know perhaps, or perhaps many of us thought that that was the end of it. But let's talk about why it's not. Why do we need this public inquiry into this case?
Well, I think undoubtedly you're right in the sense that the criminal conviction provided some comfort to the families, and Ms. Wetlaufer provided a detailed allocution. The challenge with just looking at the criminal process as being the end game of all of this is that we fail to examine some of the underlying systemic issues, and in particular with respect to how the individual nursing homes and private operators operated, and also the role of the regulator. And so, to my mind, one of the important goals of the public inquiry is to touch on those issues and to make sure that, you know, any systemic failings on those fronts are properly investigated and uncovered, and hopefully can provide a springboard for some recommendations down the road.
So essentially, these families don't believe that, you know, she just snapped and decided to murder their loved one one day, that there probably were other, you know, atrocities or awful things happening in that nursing home leading up to these murders.
No, I wouldn't go so far as to say that. I certainly don't have any information on that front. What I will say is that, you know, these things occur in a particular context. They occur in a factual context and a regulatory context and a legislative context as well. I'll give you a simple example. In order for the coroner to be called in, the attending nurse, my understanding at least, is that the attending nurse has to suggest that there was something unusual about the death. But one failing about that process is what happens when the attending nurse herself is responsible for the death. And so, you know, that's one very small example of a systemic problem.
Right.
If a coroner had been involved at an earlier stage after the death of Mr. Silcox, who was the first death, and that's actually a significant issue because the Silcox family asked for a coroner to be involved and to do an autopsy. If an autopsy had been done, would it have been possible to see the red flags and to stop this woman before she went on a multi-year spree of crimes against vulnerable seniors?
So the checks and the systems are what if I may speak, you know, with you and for you, are what need kind of to be revamped here. If we had better checks and systems, perhaps we wouldn't find ourselves in this situation today.
Well, certainly my clients absolutely think so. And the order and counsel, which created the inquiry, essentially setting its terms, expressly talks to practices, procedures, supervisory issues, the question of regulation. All of those things can and should be canvassed by the public inquiry. And certainly that's our hope, and it's going to be something we are eagerly and assertively pursuing.
Alex Van Crolligan is the attorney for some of the relatives of the seniors who were murdered by Elizabeth Wetlaufer. So as it stands right now, then, what do these checks and systems look like? Is there at any, you know, long-term facility or nursing home, can people show up to perform spontaneous checks or tests, or, you know, are government officials scheduled and they're kind of aware that people are coming in to see how they're performing and or underperforming, or how does it look right now as it stands?
Well, certainly there is government oversight, and I don't want to leave the impression that there isn't government oversight. The question is the quality of that oversight and the what I would call how in-depth is that oversight. And so I can tell you that in the cases of these homes, they absolutely were subject to government oversight. That's not the question. The question is, what are you looking for? How often are you doing these checks? And you know, are there also other regulatory issues in terms of the number of nurses that need to be on duty with all of these residents at any given time? One of the things, especially early on in Ms. Wetlaufer's crimes, is that she worked the graveyard shift, and she was often the only person there. And so if you've got a nefarious actor who's a nurse in that scenario, who is looking to hurt people, you know, she's unsupervised. It's the perfect opportunity.
Alex Van Crolligan, good luck with the inquiry.
Thanks kindly.
Thank you so much for joining us this morning. It is 9:58. We are completely out of time. Again, thank you so much for your emails and your engagement this morning. Farwell is here and on his way to take you in through 2 o'clock. Enjoy your day.